This is the State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. Most of us can get through a workday without worrying about intellectual property law. But in the course of a day's work, a documentary filmmaker may capture hundreds of copyrighted or trademarked sounds, images, and logos. The maze of laws that filmmakers must wade through is often made worse by overzealous lawyers and frivolous lawsuits. But at least one group of lawyers want to help the confused digital artist. James Boyle is a law professor at Duke University and one of the authors of Bound by Law, a new comic book. Yes, that's right, a comic book about copyright law as it applies to documentary filmmakers. The book was launched during the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival this year and attempts to explain in pictures and in plain English exactly what rights artists have. James Boyle joins me in the studio now to talk about the project. Professor?
Good morning.
Thanks for being here with us.
It's a pleasure.
This is a fascinating read.
Well, it was enormously fun creating it, although I think my colleagues give me slightly strange looks now that my most recent publication is a comic book. But
Well, let's describe this on the radio, too. You look at this cover. It's bright orange and yellow, and in the center, a buxom heroine with a video camera and a copyright shield in her hand.
Yes. Some of our readers thought there was a resemblance to Lara Croft, which I can assure you was entirely unintentional. This is our filmmaker, Akiko, and the comic book recounts the travails she goes through as she tries to make a documentary catching a day in the life of New York.
Why this form of media? I mean, why a comic book?
Yeah, I must admit it is a little unlikely. One of the people reviewing the book said three law professors write comic book. Sounds like one of those jokes that begins, the Pope, Jimi Hendrix, and Kurt Gödel walk into a bar. I mean, it sounds implausible right from the beginning. I think, you know, we first thought, we were worried by the way that the culture, what we call the permissions culture, the clearance culture, was impinging on documentary filmmakers' abilities to make film. And we were particularly worried about a new generation of digital filmmakers, you know, the kids out there with their nice digital cameras and Final Cut Pro making their documentaries for pennies. And they're running up against the walls of copyright, and they're confused. They don't have very good information about it. And we thought, okay, well, we'll write a law review article saying what's going wrong here and describing what fair use really is and the rights they have and the rights they don't have. And then, of course, we realized, well, if we write a law review article, nobody will read it except possibly us and a few of our colleagues. So as we thought about the medium in which to explore this, it seemed obvious that a comic book is one of these sort of genres that spans highbrow and lowbrow, you know, that has an ability to portray quite complex things. And above all, it captures the kind of visual craziness that goes on in some of these lawsuits.
Well, you referenced new media as you talk about the cameras and the edit systems that people are using, but also with cell phones and digital. Any way to capture images is forever changed. And so I presume that also pushed this forward.
It really did. What we're seeing is kind of a perfect storm, a conjunction of two trends. On the one hand, you have an explosion of capability to capture pictures of the world around you to make documentary films. A film, Tarnation, went to the Cannes Film Festival, and it was estimated that it cost about $218 to make the whole thing. That's just light years different from when both of us were growing up. So that's one thing, this incredible kind of democratization of the means of making documentaries. But then the other thing is we've had this surge of the permissions culture, where people are asking for permissions for fragments that before no one even thought of asking for permission for or licensing or demanding payment for. And the two things are on a collision course. We've got more and more people who know less and less about the law with more and more capability meeting a culture that's demanding more and more payment, clearance, legal hoops to jump through.
And when you say fragments, you're talking literally 3-4 seconds?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are two broad classes that documentary filmmakers have to deal with. One is the stuff that's just accidentally caught in the shot. So you're filming a bar, you're filming some kids on the street, and some music is playing from a radio, or there's a TV show going on in the background. That's part of your scene. You're recording history. Believe it or not, rights holders will demand payment for those fragments. And we are talking, as you said, seconds. John Else, who made a wonderful documentary called Sing Faster, the stagehands picture of the Ring Cycle, the Wagner opera. So you have these stagehands sitting backstage with the Simpsons playing while some large German lady is dying interminably upstairs. in a high falsetto. And The Simpsons was playing, and Els loves it. It's like, this is great. This is such a nice, you know, counterpose high culture, low culture. 4.5 seconds of The Simpsons, and the demand was for $10,000 to clear those rights.
Now, when we talk about rights clearing, I mean, a layperson can understand an artist needs to be protected.
Absolutely.
This artist has worked. There's been an investment of funds at some level to make something hopefully successful. The artist's work just can't be out there for everyone to grab and do with what they want to. It sounds, though, as if that pendulum has swung a bit too far in some cases. And are there attempts to bring it back toward the center?
Well, you put it just beautifully. I mean, the thing is, of course, artists have legitimate concerns, and there shouldn't be this sort of wholesale appropriation where people just say, oh, great, I'll use your song as the soundtrack for my movie, or I'll take, you know, 5 minutes of your video and just chuck it in there. And we were very, very firm on that in the book to say, it's not a case of anything goes. What's interesting is that the pattern of demanding these clearances has little to do with the actual law. So that if you showed some of these cases that we detail in the comic book to 100 judges or 100 law professors, all 100 of them will say, this is ridiculous. There's absolutely no legal basis for this claim. So it's not so much in this case that the law is out of balance as it is that there's a sort of private culture that everyone is just used to paying for everything and demanding clearance for everything. And as we say in the book, one of the big issues is not so much a legal one of the courts saying you must do this, but the insurance companies that provide the errors and omissions insurance necessary to screen the documentary. They're the ones who are saying, oh, we'd just rather you cleared everything. And that's actually one of the places that we directed our focus to try and get people to realize it's like when people are telling you have to clear these rights, that actually may not have any legal basis to it.
Just after I read your book, I surfed through my cable channels last evening and happened upon a documentary on African-American music and artist influence in the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a segment of artists who appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so there were these brief moments of these artists appearing in very short fragments. But I began to think about, my gracious, this person had to go through clearing dozens of songwriters, artists, managers, all of the above.
Right. And that's, I said there are two categories. The first one is the accidental capture. That's the second, this is the second category, which is you need something to tell your story. You deliberately go out and seek a particular musician to tell your story of the civil rights movement, to watch how the change in the music parallels the change in the politics, say. And there, we're also seeing a real problem. Eyes on the Prize, the great civil rights documentary, which I really thought was wonderful. I was actually going out to buy a copy on DVD for my kids. And you can't do it, or at least you couldn't until recently. Why? Because these licenses had expired. The filmmakers typically get them for 5 or 10 years. And when they expire, it's no longer legal to show that documentary or to sell it in most formats. After an incredible campaign and a massive investment of funds, it looks like Eyes on the Prize is going to be available again. But at a certain point, you wonder, well, this is part of the history. I mean, it's all very well if someone goes out and this has happened and just says, great, I'm going to rip off all of Elvis's songs, and every time Elvis appeared, I'm going to put them together, I'm going to call it The Comprehensive Elvis, and then I'm going to sell it to you, and I'm going to claim fair use. Well, that isn't fair use, and it shouldn't be, and that's what the courts have held. It's another thing if I'm telling a story about American history where the music and the newsreel clips were a part of the history. You really can't tell that history without reaching it. And in my view, many of those tiny fragments, even though consciously chosen, are also fair use. I mean, obviously, if I say, okay, I'm going to have every person who appeared on the Ed Sullivan and I'm going to play you every song that they played, that's a totally different thing. But a 15-second excerpt, there I think we ought to be asserting fair use more aggressively.
You cite an example in the book regarding Dr. Martin Luther King and how the King Family Foundation, the trust, has guarded use of his materials very closely. And an example is given where someone says, well, I understand as important as Dr. King was, continues to be, what he had to say permeates our society. If he is protected, or what he is protected, so must be the words of David Duke.
That's exactly right. And that's, I think, what people don't understand. If the person who's in the lawsuit is one of your heroes, you say, well, of course we ought to do this. Rosa Parks, for example, had a case mm-hmm. also where she, against the band Outkast. because they used the words "everybody moved to the back of the bus," and they and called the song Rosa Parks, and she wanted to have that stopped. And if that's one of our heroes or heroines, then you really sympathize for them. But the trouble is that as law professors, we have to tell you, look, these rules are going to apply to everyone. Do you really want everyone in society, regardless of what status they have, whether you see them as villain or hero, to have what is effectively a veto over the representations of them in popular culture? Because if I can't take words of yours, if I can't take pictures of yours, if I can't take the speech that you gave, that you recorded and have the copyright over, and use it unless you have agreed that I'm a suitable person, then what we're doing is we're giving people a very powerful weapon to use to sanitize portrayal of them.
To wade through all of this takes time. We're talking about a budget that is needed.
Yes, indeed. And that was one of the issues that we had in writing this. We think that a lot of these rights holders who are making this assertion, we're saying to them, you know, beware what you wish for. Because if you train a whole generation of new artists that copyright is nothing but their enemy, that it's nothing but an obstacle, that it's just a big hassle to get through, you are undermining the very people who are going to be copyright's defenders over the next 30 and 40 and 50 years. So we think that people don't realize. They say, oh, great, here's a, you know, I can demand $10,000 for a four-second ringtone on a phone. It's like, no, no one's going to respect that. No one's going to think that that's a valid law, that that's a valid exercise of legal power. And when you lose respect for a legal system, then people start violating even more blatantly. So we actually view ourselves as kind of copyright's defenders here.
Well, you know, the irony, I'm thinking, is someone who is producing a documentary now, not much money, but very creative, and is trying to get through this maze of copyright law, would in turn more than likely want their work copyrighted.
And they have it copyrighted automatically as soon as they click that button on their camera. It is copyrighted. And so they should. And one of the things we were trying to do with this work is to say, copyright's not just your enemy. Copyright is also your friend. It allows you to control your work. Who knows? You might be able to sell your documentary to PBS, and copyright's going to be a vital role in this. We actually think the basic system is pretty good. It's pretty balanced. What's got out of control is the permissions culture. And so the idea is to tell people, hey, what you're being told the law is actually not really anything to do with the actual law. And we're hoping that this format will make that message rather more accessible.
Is there a significant move for regulatory change?
I think there are a couple of different initiatives. Some people have suggested regulatory change. So some people want a very hard and firm rule. 15 seconds is okay. You know, anything less than 15 seconds. And you can see why that's attractive. The downside of that is that the doctrine we have, the law we've have, has been able to adapt to new technologies and new circumstances. If you turn it into a hard and fast rule, you lose some of that flexibility. A second approach, which I think is very useful, is that filmmakers themselves have got together and put together a code of best practices saying, we think this is fair use. And that's recently been issued and been circulated. And I think the community norms are beginning to change. So I think that's a second way of changing things.
How was this received at Full Frame?
The filmmakers were delighted. Everyone had a horror story to tell us. And I mean, the horror stories really are astounding. I mean, we were talking earlier about one in which a phone played the Rocky theme tune while a documentarian was filming a group of young people who are doing ballroom dancing. And because this phone has a copyrighted ringtone, they were demanding payment of $10,000. And no one hears that and thinks, oh, what a great system. Yeah, that totally makes sense. And the filmmakers we talked to, each one of them had a story about really heartrending and in some cases serious artistic decisions they had to make about cutting stuff out or overdubbing it. A lot of what you see in a documentary didn't happen. It's been replaced with public domain material or material that the filmmaker holds the rights to. What you think you're seeing on that TV screen in the background of the shot, what song you think is coming out of that music box, that's not really the reality.
And I'd like to point out that in this work, there are great illustrations.
That's right. And we had enormous fun trying to put those together. I should say my very talented colleague, Keith Aoki, who's the artist on this, who's actually a student of Art Spiegelman's, the famous graphic novelist, Keith and Jennifer Jenkins and I would sit there and say, okay, how can we conjure this up and what image can we use to do it? And it was an entirely different process of creativity than we were used to.
What's the topic of your next comic book?
Well, we're actually going to do another one. Our next one's going to be on music. It's going to be on the history of music and how, as music evolved, it met the law, and the two have coexisted, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. The basic question we want to ask is, if jazz or blues were being reinvented today, would it be legal? Because almost all musical traditions rely on taking stuff that other people have generated and adding your own difference to it, transforming it. Particularly jazz, where you're quoting a fragment of a prior song, or you have a little, you know, sax solo where you take a few fragments of other tunes. We accept that now. Of course, that's normal, that's legal. But the rules that we're currently applying to hip-hop artists, for example, are very different, and they're much more restrictive. And so we want to say, are we applying a model of creativity here which really ignores how creativity happens? I mean, it's almost as though we're imagining that every act of creativity is a person devoid of all social influences who just invents things out of thin air. We know, particularly with music, that the opposite is the case. What you have is a lot of people kind of stealing from each other, and out of that comes something new. So we think that if we can try and explain to people the way that copyright helps musicians, but also can restrict musical creativity, that will really have an impact.
I can see it now. There's a documentary filmmaker listening, thinking, okay, a musical about copyright laws captured on film.
I want to sing the lead.
Thank you so much for joining us today, James Boyle.
Thank you for having me.
Bound by Law was produced by Duke University Law School's Center for the Study of the Public Domain and was written by James Boyle and Jennifer Jenkins and drawn by Keith Aoki. Free digital versions of Bound by Law are available on Duke Law School's website. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show or want to hear archived editions of past programs, go to our website at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm David Crabtree.